It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
The political pageantry is over, and at the end of the Democratic National Convention, history was made. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Democrats wrapped up their convention last night with the acceptance speech of Hillary Clinton, the first woman to ever receive the presidential nomination from a major party in this country. The convention was not without dissent, some of which continues to simmer from the supporters of Bernie Sanders. Meanwhile, this week saw the closing of the Obama era as the president made his pitch for Clinton, who he hopes will continue his legacy. In our studios this morning, take a look at this week's events. Mike Prettl with the Democratic Club. Also, Billy Earle, he's with the Senate campaign of Chris Van Hollen. Barry Tillman, former mayor of Salisbury, who attended the 2008 convention and nominated Barack Obama. And Salisbury University professor Michael Laughlin. So welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So let me just sort of go around the room. Mike, I'll start with you. What was your overall impression of this convention, obviously in contrast to what we saw last week?
Well, I usually don't pay much attention to the conventions, frankly, but this year I was very much interested, and I thought the contrast between the two conventions could not have been greater. And I think the Democrats did an incredible job of capturing the high ground, while the Republicans told us that everything is terrible about America, and they have the man who's going to fix it. And I don't think he sold his case, but we'll see how it goes.
Billy, what about you?
Well, I agree with Michael. However, I think the jury's still out, and I think it's going to be a period of time before we find out whether or not the connection between Hillary and the electorate is one that is vacillating or whether it's going to be permanent.
Mm. And what about you, Barry? What do you think?
Well, I don't think it could have gone any better. I don't think they could have gotten any stronger people to speak. I think this year, more than other years, the people who spoke, the man on the street, the Muslim family who spoke last night, and who had lost a son in service to the country, I think were powerful. The mothers who spoke on, I think it was Monday night, were powerful. I think that hopefully put all together, it's going to make a big difference in some of these states that are in play. I think that we were chatting earlier, Michael Steele, who was former RNC chair and lieutenant governor of the state of Maryland for 4 years, captured it. It was the best Republican convention we've ever had. I mean, it really was optimism, quoting Reagan, shining city on the hill, and yet we are acknowledging that we are not a perfect union, that we need to work to become that more perfect union.
What about you, Michael?
I think one way to look at the two conventions is from a generic Republican perspective, they do best when turnout is low. And so for their purposes, a darker convention is actually beneficial. Whereas for the Democrats, they do best when turnout is high, and an optimistic picture, a picture addressed to the independents in the electorate, that's what the Democrats were essentially trying to do.
So, and I'll start with you again, Michael. So what did you make of particularly of Hillary Clinton's speech? It's certainly lots of progressive ideas in the speech, and yet you saw a certain outreach to Republicans and independents. You're obviously on the left side of the scale here. How did you react to it?
Well, it was an interesting combination because it was a tightrope that she was walking, essentially, because she absolutely needs the Bernie Sanders supporters. That movement is vital and vigorous and energetic, and so the progressive pitch was certainly there in terms of policy, but the coloration of the speech had a more mainstream perspective to it, and she was clearly going after independents. Independents presently make up almost 40% of the electorate now, and that is going to be the key part of the electorate that will swing this election. And Hillary Clinton, I think, made a quite effective speech, at least from looking at the convention itself.
Barry, what was your assessment? Especially, I mean, this was a history-making speech. This is the first woman ever to be nominated to presidency by a major party. I mean, I can remember Shirley Chisholm. I can remember Ferraro as vice president. I remember I was at that convention when she was nominated. What was your sense? I mean, obviously, this is a historic moment for you and for others.
Well, I'm awfully glad I lived long enough to see it. I was frustrated 8 years ago. I was certainly excited to see an African-American elected to the presidency. But, you know, I felt like it was a woman's turn then. I went to the 2008 convention as a Hillary delegate and certainly backed President Obama when it came to it. But it's very exciting for me. It's exciting for me. I have an almost 9-month-old granddaughter. And hopefully she will never consider it unusual for a woman to be nominated to the presidency or be the president. So that's very exciting to me. I think that in terms of what Hillary did in her speech, it was a difficult, as Mike said, it was a tightrope because she was following an incumbent president who had nothing to lose and was there he didn't tout his record. He talked about some of the things that have been accomplished, where we were 8 years ago, which some people seem to have forgotten how bad things were on January 20th, 2009. But he basically talked about Hillary Clinton, and it was a high ground. It was an incredible speech, and she had to come in and make her case as the one who wants to take that seat. So she had a tougher road to hoe. I think that she was definitely trying to incorporate a great deal of Bernie Sanders' progressive agenda. We were here just about 2 months ago after she locked up the numbers on the nomination, wondering what Bernie Sanders would do. Well, I think he played it well to make the platform actually matter. We commented that platforms usually don't matter. But not only has the platform been adopted and put on a shelf somewhere, it has worked its way into the rhetoric of the campaign. So I'm hopeful that she'll be able to strike that balance between mainstream, Main Street, and the more progressive, so that people feel included and come over to her.
Let me ask you before we leave you, Barry, on this. The thing about women voters, I should note, by the way, I think her name was Jerry Emmett, 102 years old, and attended the convention. And of course, she was born before the women could vote. Mm-hmm. And she said, "I surely didn't plan on living 100 years old, but when I did, I saw all these things that were happening, and it was like a shot in the arm." On the other hand, while 7 in 10 younger women support Clinton, they say by 2-1 choice that is more against Trump than for Clinton. Mm-hmm. What do you think is going on? There's obviously a certain divide that's happening here.
Well, I think that, I'm certainly of Hillary Clinton's generation. We're just a few years apart in age. And I think back to, you know, her speech that she made when she graduated from Wellesley. And I think that's the way a lot of us felt at the time, that things needed to happen, that women needed to be a part of it. And so I identify with her, whereas I think a lot of the millennials coming along were born really and had any kind of consciousness well after the first few years of Bill Clinton's first administration, when she was so active. I mean, she's been consistent, I think, in many ways in what she's tried to do, you know, work for children, work for health care, work for what we considered 25 years ago a more progressive agenda. But I think a lot of the younger women weren't there, don't see it, don't have that same frame of reference, didn't grow up in the same climate of opinion that Hillary Clinton and I did in the 50s and the 60s. So I'm hopeful that she can make that case, that their mothers can make that case, because I'm certainly making it with my daughter. And, I believe that she is a sincere woman who has been by nature and by nurture made to be a very playing it close to the vest kind of private person. And I just think that she needs to open up and let the public see the private Hillary.
So, Billy, what did you make of her speech? Did it, because obviously, as I mentioned before, it clearly laid out a lot of progressive ideas, certainly hammered out by their negotiations with Sanders. On the other hand, there was an attempt to appeal to clearly independents and to Republicans. How effective do you think it was?
I think it was very effective. Just to start off, though, I'd like to give a shout-out to an old amiga mia of mine, Sheriff Valdez from Dallas County. I worked with her on the Bill White campaign, and I'd just like to say, buena suerte y vaya con Dios, señora. What I'm hoping is that what we saw is a shift in the difference between leadership and infotainment. The ability to attract attention cannot ever be confused with the ability to lead the greatest economy and the most powerful country in the world. They're not the same. It's not the same as calling names. It's not the same as pointing fingers. I hope that what this convention did was to make it absolutely clear that experience and professionalism and competency are positives. This agent of change question to me is still quite confusing because I'm not sure what it is we want to change and how we want to change it and why it is that Hillary Clinton is not clearly identified as an agent of change. I think her entire career in politics has been in that mode, and why she is not viewed in that way to me is just a complete mystery.
Mike Prettl, what about you?
Hillary's been around so long that everybody knows her but doesn't really know her because she has been a private person. And I think, unfortunately, the Republicans tried to define her before she got out there. And, you know, I mean, and Trump especially, and I think, you know, there's no substance to it, but you throw enough mud and some of it's going to stick, you know. So I think she acknowledged in her speech that people really didn't know her and that this has to be a challenge for her to come across. I think a lot of the people who she had, in effect, testifying for her, both the constituents and some of the other more eloquent political people, I think did a good job of talking about the kind of person she really was and the kind of services she's really given to the nation. But I think that is going to be the challenge during the next few months. I mean, I'm confident that they can pull that off, and I'm confident that once people see what her track record has been, including a lot of those young folks who weren't around when she was fighting these other battles, as Barry says, you know, I think that they'll see that she's the real person and she's been a real fighter. And, you know, she has, I mean, at her age, she should be sitting back and relaxing on her laurels and the money that she's made on these speeches and that sort of thing. But instead, she's committed herself to service for the rest of her life, and she's, I think she's doing the job.
Should mention, by the way, Mike, that you have not sitting on your laurels, despite the fact you're maybe a few years older than she is. I just want everybody to know that one.
thanks.
I appreciate that, right? Yeah. Michael Laughlin, Bernie Sanders, he made his pitch on Monday night to his supporters, many of whom still were very reluctant. Matter of fact, I saw a quote from Jane Sanders, his wife, and she said she did not understand why supporters of her husband did not back Hillary Clinton. What do you make of where the Sanders voters are? I've seen polls that say maybe 80-85% of people who have polled anyway who supported Sanders will be voting, of course, for Hillary Clinton. But still, there's a portion of them, they may be small, but they're not going to accept her as the nominee.
Well, I think one of the realities of this election is that this class and the class divisions in our society are a real factor, a real dimension, and that regardless of the progressive past that Hillary Clinton genuinely can claim, I think, on the question of trade, on the question of class divisions, it is effective and I think real to attack Hillary Clinton as essentially a corporatist. One who has benefited from Wall Street, and that division and the consequences of that, the 2008 crash, and even though Obama did a good job, I think, in bailing out the economy and trying to raise things, that continues to linger in terms of working class people and lower income people. Now, the benefit here, and I think the Bernie Sanders phenomenon, as we have talked about before, is that phenomenon emerges from the continuing legacy of what has happened to working class people, particularly, certainly white working class men. And the Bernie people, I think, are now making a turn. And the question that they face, of course, is Hillary Clinton, in spite of her corporatist background, is she more accessible than someone like Donald Trump, who has no record at all of public service, has no record at all of caring for working class people? And I think that accounts for why 80% really are now beginning to turn. And I think when push comes to shove, most of the Sanders supporters will vote for Hillary Clinton rather than voting for Donald Trump.
Let me say, Michael, stay with this.
One of the actually, I ran across a quote from someone, Sanders supporter, sits on the city council in Seattle, and she said, talking about the movement, she says, "It's not a faucet. We're human beings. We're activists. We are people. We have for years been angry at not being offered a real choice. We don't believe that the Dems are any answer for Republicans." End quote. The thing that struck me, particularly when Sanders addressed the convention on Monday night, there were still boos. There was very strong opposition. And I just wonder whether or not Sanders either did not realize the energy that he was generating, whether he lost control. I mean, there seemed to be a certain surprise that suddenly for months now, we've had particularly Sanders supporters and surrogates go out and denounce Hillary and denounce and so on and so forth in some fairly tough language. And now all of a sudden they come to the convention and they're still not ready to stop.
Well, I think, again, I tried to make the point in previous discussions that the Sanders phenomenon, the movement that has come out of this, can be traced back to Occupy Wall Street, which had no leader. And Sanders simply walked in to a wave, to a base that was waiting to have some effect. And hence, Sanders now leads it in part, but he certainly does not control it. And I think that's a reality. And I think that, and we saw that, of course, at the convention when Panetta, for example, was booed, okay, because of his support for interventions and his support for the drone policy and for wars. So that I think what we'll see is that, again, I think that the majority is going to vote for Clinton, but that's not what they're in this for. They're in this for the longer haul, and I think we'll see other movements come out of this.
Barry, you mentioned a moment ago, you went to the 2008 convention as a Clinton delegate. Mm-hmm. Obviously, your person didn't win. There was a lot of dissension even then. There was the Puma movement, you know, party unity, my whatever. All right. I mean, there was real strong opposition and critique because they felt let down. They felt as if, many people said, as you indicated, that this was their time and somehow they've been deprived of it. Mm-hmm. How do you compare your experience with that and the experience in 2008 with what we're seeing with the Sanders people? Will the Sanders people, do you think, fold in, even the leadership fold into the campaign as did, say, for instance, in 2008 when those women who were really strong supporters mm-hmm. of Hillary folded into the Obama campaign?
I think a great majority of them will, as Michael said, at this point, we're looking at 7, 8, and 10 who are saying we're going to go with Hillary. I think one of the, and I'm not sure this analogy holds, but it strikes in my mind. In 1968, I was 18 years old. And I was Bobby Kennedy all the way. Now, I couldn't vote then. You had to be 21 then. But, I mean, I was Bobby Kennedy. And in fact, he was shot the night in the early morning hours after I graduated from high school. So, I mean, it was kind of like idealism and beginning your life kind of meets head-on disaster. And it was very difficult to pivot to someone like Hubert Humphrey. But then again, you learn over the years, it's not always about the person you want first off getting in there, but the person that you believe can do the job. Given, I'm loath to quote Chris Christie, but it is a choice sometimes between, it's a binary choice between two people. And in 1972, the first year I could vote, it was George McGovern or Richard Nixon. And I could not pull a lever for Richard Nixon. But yet I remember telling my husband at the time, and I told him at the time, he is still my husband, that, accepting George McGovern was kind of going out for breakfast in a great diner and getting a muffin with butter and when you really wanted scrapple and scrambled eggs, you know, but that wasn't on the menu. Yeah. And so I think that a lot of the younger voters have been very caught up in the personality of Bernie Sanders. This is a man who's given his entire life to this very progressive agenda. He's a very likable guy. I mean, he's tough, Brooklyn, tells it like it is, interesting, funny. And I think that people, especially the younger voters, have transferred their passion for his agenda into a passion for him as well, a personality thing. And it's going to take time. Hopefully they can pivot from that and understand that Donald Trump is not home for them. Donald Trump, I mean, you just hardly know what to think when he speaks. I mean, he either has an atrocious memory for things that he said in the past, or he's a liar. Neither one is not a very good thing. But I remember feeling very strongly that Hillary Clinton had given her life. It was her turn. Barack Obama was a first-term senator. He was a young guy. Get out there, support Hillary, and in 8 years, you'll be in your mid-50s. You can be president. But that's not the way it worked out. And so for me, supporting Barack Obama, and also in that election, too, I think a key element for me was watching my children for the very first time. And they were grown by that time. But watching them become engaged in the same hope that I think I felt back in the early 60s with the Kennedys. And so I felt like that was a really important ingredient that helped me pivot from Hillary to Barack Obama.
Billy, I turn to you. Chris, you're obviously engaged in a political campaign now. You're out there. You're meeting people. You're engaged in lots of folks. What sense do you get about the Sanders people in terms of where they are and the kinds of politics we're looking at, particularly the kind of politics that seems to be emerging from this movement, which has clearly shifted, certainly the platform, to what as people define anyway as the left? What sense are you getting out in terms of being out there?
Well, you know, it's funny, back in 08, you know, I was a very strong supporter of Hillary Clinton, partly because I agree with her politics, and secondly, she's my cousin. But, and this, I don't want to get too punny here, but I think they need to curb their enthusiasm. I understand passion. I understand the support of a candidate, and I love Bernie, but it's not his time. It's just plain not his time. We need to move on, and we need to be involved in this binary choice, really from a philosophical viewpoint. I heard the other day that God and guns and gays were the reason that Donald Trump had accumulated the following that he did. And I thought to myself that although that may be true, I'm a harsher critic of this underpinning than perhaps he would be. I consider it to be bigotry, Barmecide, and Blanche. And those three words in this context mean this. The bigotry that he has paraded, starting with his question of the citizenship of the president. Barmecide is a word that I love. It comes to us from the 8th century in Persia. And what it has to do is it describes the consistent mistelling of the truth in order to entice. In the great fables of Arabian Nights, what would happen is the poor would come into the nobility of Persia at the time, the Barmekis, and they would serve them gold plates with no food. Now think about that metaphorically and what Donald Trump is saying to a lot of people. The Blanche is simply what people are doing when he tries to scare them, when he tries to paint America as being a failed state, as being a disaster for the people that, quote, should be following him. I think the Sanders people will come around in overwhelming numbers, but there still is going to be a group that have their feelings hurt, and they're probably new to politics, and they're probably people who had a viewpoint of Bernie that was somewhat unrealistic. I've been there. I loved George McGovern. I was as unrealistic as anybody could possibly be. But I think that they will come in, and I think a lot of it will be a product of the mistakes and the things that Donald Trump will say from today until November 8th.
You, by the way, you mentioned your cousin?
Mm-hmm.
How did that happen?
You know, if you're Celtic, you know, you're related to almost everybody if you go back far enough. My mother is the lineage director for Daughters of the American Revolution for the state of Texas, and she's done this, and I'm related to everybody from Richard Nixon to John Kennedy to everybody. But Hillary's the one that cousins. I love right now.
Okay. Or at least a distant cousin
she's
anyway,
I guess,
right?
Cousin right now.
Yeah, that's right.
Fifth and seventh cousins.
So Mike Prado, what's your assessment?
Very, very briefly, 2 points. One, I saw a polling a couple of weeks ago that indicated that actually following the 2008 primary, there were more people that were Hillary people, never Obama, than there are today of the people who are voting to shift. So, you know, So, and secondly, I mean, I've been playing with Facebook a good bit lately, and I have a number of Facebook friends, some of whom are on the Bernie camp, you know. Most of them are saying, I'm not yet ready to move. Right. And I can understand that. I also work with, I was on the executive committee of the Maryland chapter of the Sierra Club, and we have a few diehards who keep talking about the TPP and keep talking about, you know, those sorts of things. And they, you know, they, again, it looks to me like they are not ready to make that commitment just because they had this emotional reaction, emotional commitment to Bernie, and they were criticizing Hillary for, you know, her, some of her positions, sort of tangential positions. But anyway, I guess the bottom line is I think all those people will, when faced with the continuation of the Trump tirade, they will come around. So I'm not really worried that we're going to lose any significant number of the Bernieites too. Look, I voted for Bernie myself. Partly because I subscribed to a lot of what he was promoting, and partly because I want to be able to tell the Bernie people now, look, I voted for Bernie, but now we all got to get behind Hillary. So, you know.
The strategic vote.
Strategic vote. Well, we do that sometimes, you know.
Want to turn to Senator Tim Kaine. And I'll ask you, Michael Laughlin. It was an interesting choice, certainly puts Virginia into play, I suppose, even though last figures I saw, I think Hillary's up by 10, I think, in Virginia. On the other hand, there was some dissatisfaction, certainly from the Sanders folks, in regards to his support for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the Free Trade Agreement. He's apparently supported Fast Track Authority. On the issue of abortion, apparently, while he's gotten a 100% rating from Planned Parenthood Action Fund, he did support 24-hour waiting period, parental notification, and some restrictions on government funding, although apparently he now favors repealing the Hyde Amendment, which prohibits federal funds from going to perform abortions. What do we make of this particular candidate? I mean, we made a lot last week about the fact that Pence, the running mate for the Republican nominee, it had differing views. How do you assess? Is Kaine closer? What do you think?
I think the strategic judgment that was made was that Hillary Clinton needed first to nail down another state, and I think that the Virginia can be safely predicted will be Democratic come November. So that is job number one. Job number two, and the more important job really, is that Hillary Clinton, being the first woman candidate and being quite vulnerable to losing that white male working class and lower middle class voter, put on the ticket a white man who has some moderate to conservative social positions in his background, Catholic, has that kind of background, so that he can weigh in and essentially assuage the worries of that part of the demographic, that part of the class demographic. So that, I think, is the appeal. Again, to the extent that vice presidential choices matter, which is less persuasive, but nonetheless, she protects her right flank, I think, by this choice. Whereas a choice of Elizabeth Warren, however vigorous and vital and persuasive Warren would be for the progressive left side of the Democratic Party, that would not help in terms of where the Clinton folks are most vulnerable in terms of the electoral map.
Barry, do you see this as more of a strategic move here? I should mention, by the way, that Kaine was criticized, I think, by a Rhode Island bishop, Thomas Tobin, for his issue positions on abortion, same-sex marriage, and gay adoption. Mm-hmm. So he certainly has separated some of his religious or his church beliefs from his political beliefs. Do you think this was more of a strategic, or was this something that somebody she just got along with? I mean, in many ways.
I think you check a couple of boxes with Tim Kaine. I think that, first of all, you've got a proverbial Caesar's wife. You know, he's above reproach and criticism. I mean, he's married to the same woman for 30 years, attended the same church for the same 30 years, was a missionary in Honduras. I mean, he's got some really good credentials as a caring, compassionate guy. And I think Michael's right. It, you know, it was a balance on the ticket. I think it would have been a strategic mistake to have somebody like Elizabeth Warren on the ticket, even though it would have played very, very well with those three or four or two or three and 10 Bernie Sanders supporters. I think it would have been a mistake. And also, I think that Elizabeth Warren is much better out there on her own, just laying into Donald Trump. I don't think anyone does it better than Elizabeth Warren. But I also think that what I've read about Hillary Clinton, what I believe I know about Hillary Clinton, that she felt comfortable with Tim Kaine, that it was a personal decision. She could check that box off, that she was comfortable with him, comfortable with his family, and comfortable in a partnership with him in the White House. And I think that she's using perhaps the Obama-Biden a partnership as her model. I mean, she and Bill Clinton, for all their travail, have always been a partnership. And I think she's looking for that confidant, that partner. So I think she could check that box. She could check the box of appealing again to the white working class. I think that she picked a good guy, just, you know, the proverbial good guy whom she felt comfortable with.
Billy, your assessment, two things. One is what you thought of his performance as in terms of his speech. And also there is, when we're talking about baggage, there is an issue of gifts. Now, they weren't illegal, and it's clear that this was not a McDonald's situation where you get the expensive watch. But nonetheless, that certainly is going to be an issue out here. What about those two?
It is going to be an issue, and I don't think that the quid pro quo portion of that equation is going to be paid enough attention to. Tim was a safe bet. He's a good bet. His speech was workmanlike, and I think that it was perfectly competent. I think what his role in this is to give the ticket a certain kind of flavor. And I can tell you, and this shocked me, I had two calls from people in Texas who are avowed Trump supporters who both loved Tim Kaine and said they were now going to consider voting for Hillary Clinton. And I was shocked because these are people that I never thought that they would put as much emphasis on a vice presidential candidate component of a ticket as apparently has occurred here. I'm a big fan of Tim Kaine, and I think she made a great choice.
What do you make of it? And did he seem? I've not seen him up close and personal in the sense of, you know, because I haven't lived in Virginia many, many years, but he seemed very animated, and I mean, it was maybe, I don't know, it was a little too hot for the TV camera, but nonetheless, it was a very engaging kind of address.
Well, as one who was very enthusiastic about Elizabeth Warren, and originally thought it'd be a great ticket, and yeah, although everyone's concerned about the fact that there'd be a Republican appointment to the Senate if she gave up her seat there. And I frankly haven't followed Kaine that closely. I did, someone suggested, I did look at the speech he gave the night before, 2 days before in Florida, and I thought he was wonderful. And it's funny because he's a Harvard-educated lawyer who also has been a missionary in Honduras, who is also incredibly down to earth. And I think he really goes a long way toward humanizing Hillary, or to fill in some of those pieces that people may be concerned about. They don't understand Hillary, and Hillary doesn't. I think he relates extremely well. And I think, you know, he's a strong family guy. Also, his wife is the daughter of a very popular Republican governor of Virginia, which is, you know, certainly something that's going to be in his stead. I mean, he was a good centrist, as I recall, and, you know, very, very well received by both parties, I guess. And also, he's a guy who apparently has a track record for working across the aisle quite well. You know, and I think that's something that hasn't been mentioned enough, but both Hillary and Kaine have been good people to work with the other party. And, you know, and as much as I love Obama and I think he's a wonderful man, I think that was a major deficit that he never was able to establish that contact with the, and it just wasn't his personality to invite people. And Hillary is saying that from day one, she's going to be in there working with the other party. And I think Kaine very well supplements her on that.
He was a mayor, too. Hmm. He started out
that's
as a
right,
mayor.
That's right, the mayor.
I mean, that's like the best street creds you can get.
Mayor, the governor. Yeah, that's right.
Coming from a mayor, yes.
Of course, he moved up.
Michael Laughlin, I want to turn to you because we are mentioning, of course, President Obama. I guess the speech was his swan song. I mean, he obviously will be out there, but we really are coming to the end of an era. As a matter of fact, Nicole Wallace from the campaigned for in 2008 for the Republican Party, she said that while she disagreed with him on lots of issues and so on, that she was going to miss him. What do you make of his legacy?
Well, I think the fact that, unlike previous presidents, the fact that Barack Obama is charging into the electoral fray and clearly will be out there on the campaign is evidence that he sees Hillary Clinton and the possibility of a Democratic Senate as carrying forward and protecting his legacy. One should keep in mind that Barack Obama's policy agenda has largely been stuck because of the Republican opposition. Barack Obama has been in favor of some increase in the minimum wage. Barack Obama has been in favor of increasing health insurance coverage. Barack Obama has been in support of a number of progressive policy programs that have been stopped by the Republicans. And for Donald Trump to get in there, Barack Obama's legacy could be destroyed. And certainly all of these other policy positions, these programs that Barack Obama really wants to see come to fruition would be stopped. So he has and again, I think there's real commitment on his part and the possibility of playing a big role in the campaign, I think, is there.
Barry, what's your sense about his legacy? I mean, you started obviously out as somebody who supported mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton, but we're coming to the end of 8 years. I mean, it's been a very long time. Mm-hmm. What's your sense about his legacy?
Well, I think that, you know, obviously we need some time and distance to really evaluate that. I think when Harry Truman left office, he was 20% or 25% maybe. And everybody was, you know, here's your hat, what's your hurry? But I think so we need some of that. But I do think he's leaving the presidency in a very important place of high esteem. I mean, his numbers, he's out there on the campaign trail because he's got the numbers, favorability ratings to carry that off. I think his legacy is certainly having broken a barrier, becoming the first African-American president. He has struggled. I think that we cannot understate or underestimate the power that the fact that a lot of his opposition has been because he is an African-American. People have, you know, had trouble with it. I mean, the Republican leadership was right in there, adamant from the very beginning. You know, we want to make sure this guy's a one-termer. Well, that didn't work out because Barack Obama's a much more talented politician. But I think he's definitely willing to use political capital in order to continue the bulk of his agenda. But having said that, I don't think Hillary Clinton is going to be Barack Obama light at all. She's going to be Hillary Clinton, the 45th president of the United States. And I think that a lot of the hard work that he has begun, she will continue in her way and with her spin and with her touch on it. But I just think that Barack Obama's legacy is that of a man who believes in what he has done. And even though he has struggled with what he has done, Mike alluded to it, he has not been great at working across the aisle, but the aisles haven't been really very welcoming to him. And so I think that, you know, we have to get some time and see what his second act brings with his legacy and how that affects him. But, you know, you see Bill Clinton, for all the criticism that swirls around the Clintons, he's still got real high favorability ratings. And I think that's important to Barack Obama. He's a young man as he enters that second chapter to preserve that legacy. And he's going to use his capital this fall to do that.
Billy, in terms of the president's legacy, one of the things that seems to have occurred is that when he entered office, some of the underlying racism of the country seemed to come to the surface. It's not that it was created to just come to the surface. And that's not to say that all his opponents or his critics were racist, but there just seemed that come to the surface. What do you make of what that means for the country? And now that we've elected, say, a woman or we may elect a woman as president, let's not get ahead of ourselves here. would Hillary Clinton then bring some of, say, a certain amount of misogyny, sexism to the surface? I mean, are we looking at some really interesting dynamics here that perhaps from a social point of view we've never looked at before in terms of the presidency because, well, they've always been white men?
That's a brilliant question. Yes, it's going to surface. When I was living in Texas at the time, the degree to which the criticism of the president was made, there was always a very strong underpinning of racial bias in this, and the misogyny issue is going to be prevalent here. Now, what I'm hoping happens is that the president has taken command of the issue of exceptionalism with his speech the other night, and I'm hoping that he can pass this on to Mrs. Clinton and allow her to use that theme through this campaign and in her role as president and overcome. And I'm going to bring a term back from the ancient past and put an end to these nattering nabobs and their negativity. And I'm sure there's other alliteration that could take place here. But, yeah, I think we're going to see, in the same way that we saw the, quote, end to racism and it became worse, we're going to see the same thing with the issue of having a woman leading the free world.
Michael Prettl, what's your assessment? Also, one of the interesting things I find is that Barack Obama has obviously had to walk fairly delicately when it comes to the issue of race. And we've had a number of incidents where African Americans have either been killed by police or, for instance, they had on the stage the mothers, I think it was 8 mothers on the stage, which included not only people, not only African Americans who were subject to, say, police violence, but also we had Trayvon Martin's mother, which was a watch person, a neighborhood watch person. We had other folks who, African Americans, who died, not just simply by police. How do you see this party sort of straddling this? Because on the other hand, we had police, the survivors of police, a family of policemen who had been killed. They also were on the stage, and they've really tied these two things together. We have to concern ourselves with African Americans and their deaths in terms of police, but we also have to protect the police. How do you see them dealing with this issue?
Not to get into the police thing, but to get into the original question you asked about the women issue. I sort of wish my wife was here to address that because Michelle's been a strong feminist since for 50 years now, you know. And frankly, to her credit, she is leery about having a woman elected at this point just because she tends to see the deficit. You know, it's funny because younger people don't pay much attention to that, I guess. But women who had to fight those battles and with some success and not so successful in other areas are somewhat concerned about how Hillary is going to be received. Frankly, I think her approach to it, I don't share that serious degree of concern, because I think the way that Hillary deals with it is to some extent in the issues she chooses to address and to hammer home all the time. I think she understands foreign policy. I think she understands economic policy, but yet she is championing children and championing women's issues to the point that I don't think a man could do effectively. So I think, I think she will handle it well. I think there will be some misogyny, if you will, some problems surfacing either overtly or more covertly if she's elected. But I think she can deal with it. And she's used to dealing with bills, so she should be able to deal with other people. But let me go back to your other. I don't want to get into the Trayvon Martin and all that. But one of the things I've commented several times recently, I think the outrage or the tragedy of the last 10 years has been that I think Obama, for all his faults, I think is the finest human being we've elected president in my lifetime in the last 75 years. And I think it's an utter tragedy that he has, I think he's had a lot of successes, a lot of great successes. But it just occurs to me, I mean, if we had somebody on the other side, you know, Everett Dirksen as the Republican leader, you know, how much could have been accomplished with this talented, intelligent, long view person as president? And it's such a waste that he spent all those years just fighting against an intransigent Congress that he couldn't move. So I think it's outrageous. I hope his future after January, I hope he falls into something that will permit him to be more productive or continue to be productive in the public interest. But But I think it's just a tragedy that he has not been better received by a vast part of the electorate as he should have been.
Michael Loftow, I'm going to kick the police issue over to you here. So what do you think? How they handled this?
I think very, very well, frankly. I mean, I think they, and it's interesting because I think, again, if we keep in mind that those who shape these conventions are strategic thinkers, the independent voters are the ones that they're aiming for. And those independent voters, okay, are open to both the question of that Black Lives Matter on the one hand, but you have to address the blue lives question, that is, you know, what's happening to police officers. And I thought it was really miraculous, almost, the way they performed that, because I thought they really did succeed, it seems to me, at least in terms of the overall impression of the viewer, that Hillary Clinton was worried about both sets. And so the welcoming of both questions here was developed there in that convention.
I want to turn to Donald Trump. I'll start with you, Barry. What do you make of his reaction? And I mean, the latest thing to come up, well, a couple of things. One is his comments regarding Russia. He's quote, "Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing. I think you will probably be rewarded mightily by our press," end quote. 30,000, of course, mm-hmm. refers to the emails that were raised on Clinton's private server. And then just, I think it was just yesterday, he talked about how angry he was at some of the people who criticized him mm-hmm. at the convention and said he'd like to hit somebody, but he would be restrained. What do you make of...
I have dealt with people like Donald Trump, and I think that he is a classic example of someone who is suited, obviously, well to the business community, to the developer mentality, and has had a brilliant career. He is completely unsuited to be in any elected office. I'm talking about everything from the city council to of New York or any city to the presidency of the United States. He's very thin-skinned. He cannot hold his tongue. He cannot hold his temper. I think the comment on the 30,000 emails was probably something that just came off the top of his head with no thought as to what he was exactly saying, what he was opening up the United States to. I either way, I mean, if he knew exactly what he was saying and was violating, you know, the Logan Act or whatever, or if he didn't, either one says you don't have what it takes to be president. He seems. They asked him, "What do you who gives you policy advice?" Well, I have a great mind. I kind of just listen to the morning shows and figure things out on my own. You know, when you are in a position like that, and you have no interest in learning, and don't know what's going on, it's a very bad combination. I mean, whether you're on the city council, whether you're the mayor, whether you're in the state assembly, the U.S. Congress, wherever you are, a governor's chair, you have got to be willing to listen to lots of different points of view and lots of different briefings so that you can make the most informed decision. And when you say, "Hey, I got a great mind, I pretty much listen to myself," everybody's in trouble.
Billy, I want to turn to you, because one of the observations I think that's been made is that Trump seems to be part of a sort of a battle for the soul of the Republican Party, that he's taken obviously a number of positions that are not part of the conservative movement. In fact, quite the opposite. Free trade, for instance, is one of the big ones. And now, he's put Governor Pence on his ticket, which seems to represent that at least older conservative movement. What do you make of what's happening to that party? Is Trump part of a new phenomenon in which those voters, who, even if he loses, will be there 4 years from now? Or is he just simply a blip and he will come, he will go, and then the Republican Party will then come back into its conservative roots?
I remember 4 years ago, I think it was Paul Beglia said that he envisioned a time when the Republican Party would become regionalized because they were becoming too extreme and too vitriolic in their language and in their action. Donald Trump, to me, and I've lived in Manhattan and I've known trust fund kids, and I've known him in the financial area, and he is so typical of that type of person, which is not what we think of, I think, when we historically think of the Republican Party. When I was growing up, Rockefeller Republicans were eminently reasonable people, and there was always the efforts to try and get things done, but there was a slightly different approach. But I think what we've got now, we've got a boy who is just, in his mind, so entitled and in some ways such a cowardly bully that he feels like this pulpit is going to be an advantage for his brand. I honestly don't think when he got into this that he ever envisioned that he would be the Republican candidate for the presidency of the United States. But now he's there, and in his mind, he must continue this, and he will until he fails. Now, when he fails, the Republican Party will fail also, and we're going to see something new. We're going to see something different. It can't reconstruct itself. It's fallen off the wall, and that egg is broken.
Mike Prettle, what do you think? What's, in particularly in relationship to, say, the Democratic Party, I mean, I can remember a time where Republicans would disagree. I mean, Bob Dole, for once, sure. But yet he worked on, you know, I think with school lunches, and then there was this effort to certainly provide insurance for kids and so on. There were things that were done, including, I might add, welfare reform, which obviously has been sharply criticized on the left. Where is this party going?
I don't have anything profound to say about it. I think he is certainly an anomaly, even in the Republican Party. You know, they've been building this conservative movement for a lot of these many years now. And, you know, they had 60 conservatives running against him, and he beat them all. You know, now maybe he beat them because there were 16 of them and they couldn't agree on a champion. I think it does raise the question, where is the conservative movement in the Republican Party going? A number of conservative commentators have raised that issue themselves. Are they dead? You know, is this the death knell? I mean, certainly Trump represents some of the worst aspects of the so-called conservative movement. Or he had picked pieces, especially the anti-Hillary and the subtle racism, if not overt racism, of some of the conservative thinkers and demagogues, if you will. But he's an outgrowth of that. I mean, the Democrats have said, look, the conservatives have been saying this for a number of years, and now Donald Trump comes and he sort of embodies the worst of that movement. I don't know whether they can regroup afterwards, it remains to be seen. As far as the Democratic Party is concerned, I mean, I think, and someone commented on it last night after the thing, that Trump may be the best thing to happen to the Democratic Party, because he really has reinvigorated them, have given them a purpose, have given them a focus, you know, have brought some of the Bernie elements into the mainstream of the party. And, you know, I mean, if the Democrats win and win resoundingly, I think the Trump phenomenon, Trump will go away into the ignominy that perhaps he deserves, and I think the party will be much stronger for it.
Michael Lofman, what do you think? You're a political science professor. You watch these things, try to get beyond just simply the day-to-day news coverage. What do you think is happening to this party? I mean, is he just a passing phenomenon?
No, I don't think he is. I think that if we don't look closely, again, at the phenomena of Trump on the one hand and Bernie Sanders on the other, we lose sight of the underlying economic character of what has generated this particular electoral cycle. And if Hillary Clinton wins the presidency and she and the Democrats do not address the underlying economic and financial conditions of working class people, the phenomenon that brought Trump to the fore and brought Bernie Sanders to the fore will continue, will appear, and will generate a similar kind of dark side of the American political society. And the racism and the bigotry combined with economic hardship and financial despair, that is what I think fuels the Trump and Trumpism, which is a quasi-fascist movement. We will rue the day that we do not address these problems. So just the election of Hillary Clinton is not going to put this to rest. The question is whether actual policy will advance and take care of these kinds of dimensions of our society.
Let me ask you this, because I was thinking about this the other night. We were talking about Trumpism, right? And he clearly is a critic of internet free trade agreements and this engagement. But it also occurred to me, and that's defined as globalization, but it also occurred to me that he also pushes back on, say, the military engagements we have. And I'm not just talking about simply Iraq or Afghanistan. I'm talking about Europe. I'm talking about Asia. There seems to be in this phenomenon, this movement, a sense of we need to pull back, that globalization has hit us so hard, whether it's losing a job, whether it's free trade, or whether it's young men and women who go and die in foreign wars, or the expense of maintaining troops in countries, even if they're not engaged. There's like Trumpism seems to be a pullback from what has traditionally been, at least since the Cold War, this continued engagement, whether it is economic or military or foreign policy-wise.
I don't take Trump seriously. I mean, I think that.
I think that's true.
No, I think that is true. I think that he is touching a nerve of many Americans who see the trade deals as selling out our jobs and see these foreign wars as worthless interventions, and that there are a lot of Americans who would prefer to pull back from all of that. However, Trump, I think, the rhetoric, I mean, he would be an interventionist. I mean, when he talks about that he's going to annihilate ISIS, I mean, how's he going to do that? He's going to send the American army back in there. I mean, if anybody actually, they're foolish to actually take him at his word. And with regard to the trade deals, I mean, this man has worked his entire life to enrich himself, right? That's his only goal in life. And the idea that somehow he's going to work towards trade deals that would protect the American worker is really preposterous on the face of it.
But that's what people believe.
That's what people believe. But that's not,
and he's tapping into something here.
Absolutely, yes. No, I agree with that, and I think
which taps into the Sanders issue as
absolutely.
Well, because we saw for instance in that convention, we didn't just see opposition to the Pacific Trade Agreement. We saw no war. We saw, as you pointed out, with the booing of Panetta.
Yes, and those features, I think, are going to continue. And again, depend on whoever is the next president. I mean, depending on what they do, they can either put to rest those kinds of issues, or those will continue to be fuel for the next electoral cycle come 2020.
Just briefly, go around the country, around the table here, Barry. So, what are you predicting a major victory by Hillary Clinton, or are you? What's your guess?
It's really hard to say today. I don't understand how we have a situation where Donald Trump is so underwater with Hispanics, with African Americans, with women, and yet he's still running so neck and neck in some of these polls. I'm hoping that coming out of this convention, moving into Labor Day, you're going to start seeing the effect of the Sanders people moving into the Clinton column, and that she's going to be able to pull away. And it will be, if not a landslide, I'm praying an easy victory, and certainly a victory.
Okay, we're going to have to actually leave it there. We're running out of time here, but I want to thank our guests. Mike Predley is with the Democratic Club. Also, Billy Earle, he's with the Senate campaign of Chris Van Hollen. Barry Tillman, former mayor of Salisbury, also attended the 2008 convention. It was a Clinton delegate back then. And, of course, Salisbury University professor Michael Laughlin. Appreciate you all stopping by.
Thank you.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.